Good evening, everybody. We're glad to be back with you here on in Kansas City. It's a summer Wednesday. We got some heat going on, but this is Ebony's Bones. I am your host, Ebony Johnson, along with our co-host, Professor AJ Lowe.
Hey.
And today we are excited. Professor Lowe, this was a connection that you made in your travels and all your adventures that you do as a historian. We're glad to have on the phone with us Ms. Vanessa Adams Harris, who works with Outreach and Alliances with the John Hope Franklin Center for Reconciliation. And today we will be talking about Black Wall Street, the history of it, how we can build our own. There's a blueprint that was already done, but also some horrific things that have happened in our history and that's still currently happening. So I'm sure, especially Professor Lowe, will be able to draw some parallels. But with that being said, good evening, Ms. Vanessa Adams Harris. Thanks for being with us.
Good evening. Thank you guys so much for having me.
It's wonderful to hear from you again.
Yes.
Yes.
So, Ms. Adams Harris, can you start us off with who is John Hope Franklin? And, you know, then we'll talk about Black Wall Street and the work that you all are doing, but give us some history on who he is.
Dr. Franklin, for me anyway, Dr. Franklin is and should be considered one of our most important historians of our lifetime. He has since passed in 2009, but his work as a historian, as an African-American man who he didn't like necessarily to say he was a black history historian, but he was a black man that knew history and studied history, which he often would say that history, African-American history, was American history, too. And so we just hadn't heard about it always because, of course, African-American people weren't the ones in control of the system to get that history out. He was born here in Oklahoma in a small town called Rentiesville, which is a little bit away from Tulsa. He subsequently moved to Tulsa in about 25, in 1925. He was born in 1915. His mother and father, Buck Colbert Franklin was his father. His mother's name was Molly, were educated. His father was an attorney. And if you know anything about Oklahoma, that a black man being an attorney in Oklahoma was an anomaly. But Buck Colbert Franklin, Dr. Franklin's father, was just that, an attorney here, probate lawyer, actually. Dr. Franklin graduated from the Booker T. Washington School here in Tulsa, went from here to Fisk University. From Fisk, went on to Harvard, where he received his master's and his Ph.D. His seminal work for his Ph.D. was his book, From Slavery to Freedom. That book is a magnificent resource book in its ninth edition today, first published in 1947. And Dr. Franklin wrote that book and continued to write books, write essays and such that explained and unpacked African-American life, stories, history, and such. So that's just a little bit who he was. He retired from Duke University, emeritus status professor, history of law, and subsequently passed away in Durham, North Carolina in 2009.
Hmm. Thank you for sharing that background on John Hope Franklin. And can you go into the John Hope Franklin Center for Reconciliation, what it is, what it does, how it actually came about? You are in Tulsa, Oklahoma. I do want to share that with our listeners in case they are interested in where this center is and interested in taking a visit. But share with us the vision and mission of that center, and then we'll go into the story of Black Wall Street.
The center really began in a little bit before anything else was happening here. Since we are the home of 1921 massacre slash race riot, and I'll explain why I use those two words together later on. The center came about through the work of not only local, but national historians like Dr. Franklin, that we needed something here in this city that could ground us as we began to unpack this most horrific history of not only Oklahoma and the city of Tulsa, but the United States of America. The center is just, we are just an office, actually. We office inside of a building, and now we have moved our office to another building, but we are over Reconciliation Park. Reconciliation Park is a place that we are part of an international site of conscience, and so we delve into these histories. We have a yearly symposium around the work of, that's a national symposium, around the work of reconciliation. And our theme this year was reconciliation and technology, and so we have a national speaker that comes in and unravels what that might be about. And then we have a community dinner that's done. The symposium is done at the anniversary of the massacre, and this was our 11th year. The dinner is done the third week in November, and it's a community dinner. And at the community dinner, we also have a national speaker. And it's a way for people from all over the city and even from out of town will come in for our community dinner, which is, we seat anywhere from 500 to a little over 550 people. And it's a dinner that people can afford. We use the local school, their culinary arts program, and they prepare the dinner. And we ask people to sit with someone that you do not know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Thank you for giving us that. Oh, go ahead.
The park has been open since 2010. The community members that gathered together were not only local historians, but national historians, as well as taking information guided by Dr. Franklin and others to kind of bring this together. With the artwork at the park by Ed Dwight. Ed Dwight is our first African-American pilot to the NASA program in 1961. He was called by John F. Kennedy to be a part of becoming maybe the first black astronaut, and he was denied that access to that programming as an astronaut, even though he passed all the tests and was a pilot for them. He did not get to be named as the first black astronaut because, of course, of racism in America. But he turned that attention towards sculpting because he was also an artist. So that engineering, those two engineering degrees he earned in addition to an MFA in sculpting brought out his work as a sculptor. And so we have the artwork of Ed Dwight in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Mm-hmm.
Wonderful. Can you share for our listeners who have never heard of the story of Black Wall Street and what happened with the massacre and what it was even about even before the massacre? Just share that story and paint a picture for us, if you could, of how Black people created that community and sustained that community and what it the degrees that you can to what it felt and looked like and what it did for us as a people.
Okay. Well, it's a pretty simple story, actually. And we have had several models before we get to Oklahoma. There are already models of successful black people having homes and buildings and professional lives. The African-American people that came to this area of the country, which initially would have been Indian territory, Oklahoma is a late state. It didn't become a state until 1907. And with statehood came some additional things. And one of the things that statehood introduced in Indian Territory, actually, was kind of putting black people in a certain position, almost calling them specifically black people so that you would know that these are the people we're talking about, because here in Indian Territory, you have some mixed ethnicities happening here, where you have Native American and African American peoples living together. And actually, some of those people of African descent were in the tribes, were part of the tribes, and with tribal citizenship, you had land. And land gave you wealth. And that's how we actually get these anomalies called black towns, which were not all black towns. They were actually tribal towns where the tribes had for their black citizens. So when you look at a place like Tulsa, and Tulsa was formed out of the Muscogee Creek Nation, which is one of the five civilized tribes, which we need to look at them also as a colonized group of people, then you can see that who was in this area called Tulsa, which was really originally a Creek town, Creek name. The Creek Indians were the ones that actually founded Tulsa. Tulawa is the Creek word for it, that founded this place, platted the town, platted the city. And some of those people were actually people of African ancestry as well. And so how do we build a city out of this is, you know, whites come in with the railroads and come in with already knowing that oil is being surveyed, the land has already been surveyed, so oil is already found on various properties, all of those properties being Indians, being within those tribal nations that land is found. And so the whites begin to marry into the tribe. And when the whites marry into the tribe, they gain access to land. So we get a building up of a town then that becomes a city, because as we get statehood happening in 1907, then you see these men who are trying to build a city, and they start competing with the other side of the state, being Oklahoma City side of the state, because we're talking about Tulsa is in the eastern section of the state. Oklahoma City is the western section. The Tulsa area is considered Indian Territory. The Oklahoma City area is considered Oklahoma Territory. So we had what's called twin territories here. One side, the cattlemen, is over in the Oklahoma Territory, and this side over here is Indian Territory, so it deals more with oil. So what does oil and looking for oil and gaining the rights to land ownership to get the minerals out of the land have to do with this? So a lot of black people that then came to Oklahoma that were already here in Oklahoma, already in Indian Territory, came into a city environment because, like most people, you want to kind of leave the country sometimes and you want to come into the city because the city seems so exciting. So not only were these people looking for opportunities, a lot of historians like to say that, you know, black people would migrate to look for opportunities. When you come into a city, you're coming in to really be the support system of those whites that are already here and building up that city. So we kind of have to take a bird's eye view of this and really look at how people were negotiating under this kind of condition of what's Jim Crow here in Oklahoma. Because the first law of the land of the state of Oklahoma was a separatist law. The first law of the city of Tulsa was a separatist law. You know, the system is designed to try to keep people separated from each other by any means necessary. So when you have workers coming in here, people that are coming from small towns and they're coming in here, and maybe they are a little educated, and then there's another group of people that come in here and they're very educated. And because you're in a separatist town, a separatist state, then, of course, there's a certain area that's designated for you, and that's the area where you buy land, and then you're able to have a place where other people that look like you can come in and live and hopefully try to, you know, set some things down and support themselves. And that's what these people did here, because unlike what you know, the story is supposed to be about black people, that they're lazy and shiftless and can't do anything. Well, you know, I don't know how Plantation was able to be run if that was the case. I don't know how a man got to make so much money if black people are so lazy and shiftless. That we need to just throw that thing way over to the side and not ever pay attention to that, because we have evidence of an opposite actually being the case, where whites really were surveyed and studied and thought to be the ones that were lazy and shiftless. And the better worker was that African, that black person that was the better, harder worker. Not that they could be controlled, but because they had an integrity to their work ethics and got the work done. So anyway, back here in Oklahoma, you have a community of colored people who are working under their condition of Jim Crow, and they are supporting themselves. And they're choosing not to try to buy in those white stores that would not sell to them. They are choosing to stay in their own community and do what Booker T. Washington said, do, you know, pull yourself up by your bootstraps, do for yourself. Commerce within your own community and be the support system to those whites who want to live that way. And so you had black maids. You also had shoe cobblers. You had movie theaters, confectionery stores, billiard halls, of course. But you had schools. You had educators. You had lawyers. You had doctors. You had dentists, shopkeepers, grocery stores. You had a, before you know it, by the time we get to 1920s, you had over, you know, 9,000, 10,000 black people living in a particular area of town with a street called Greenwood, which was the street that was designated where black people would live. Mm. Initially, a man by the name of O.W. Gurley is thought to come into Tulsa in about 1904, purchased 40 acres or so of land, and we don't know how he purchased that. Did a white man come in and purchase the land for him? Because you already had separatists and segregationist people living here already. So how did he purchase that land? We're still kind of unraveling that. And you have, you know, so we have to look at how was this relationship negotiated? You know, how did they do this thing on the one hand, and then how did they sustain it on the other hand? They sustained it by having to stay within their own confines of these little kind of 40-square blocks. And they did that very successfully, all the while always challenging the city for better housing conditions, better streets, better sewage, better electricity, better gas, all the things that any city is responsible for providing for its citizens. They were always challenging the city to do that right thing. But after World War One, when those soldiers who had gone to fight, or those people who knew about the war, which everybody knew about the war, and reading the newspaper and all the articles that were going back and forth, you had Pullman porters, you had porters that lived here in the district, in the area. So you had a level of information that was happening. We don't want to forget about how information traveled, how people, what are the effects of reading and reading good information and having that information then disseminated back out to you. They were good communicators back then. And once they came back from the war and they decided that they were going to start speaking up just a little bit more, because they were already speaking up. So we can never think that black people were not talking about stuff before, you know, some kind of attack or uprising. Black people have always been fighting for their right to be who they are and be free. And they've always been struggling and fighting for that. So we can never think that it just started. So these people had to come from somewhere with that information already. And then we get to 1921. 1921 does not mark the first time that anyone has been lynched or killed here. There's been some kind of a disturbance. It was kind of permeating and kind of rocking along after the war. There had been two lynchings before 1921. And so they did not want, and one was a white man, one was a black man. And so the soldiers that went down to the courthouse, or some of the men that went down to the courthouse that night after they had heard about this young man being arrested, and they heard and knew that there was going to be this rumbling from the other side of the railroad tracks to come and lynch him, and that's what they heard, they went down there to protect him. And when they got down there, there was a talk, and they were talking back and forth. And so then the white men came, and they were, you know, like men do, they were talking back and forth. And then they dispersed. And the black men came back to Greenwood, and then the white men, you know, kind of stayed around. And then they went back down there and got into a big kind of a scuffle. A shot was fired, and they fought. So they actually fought right there in downtown Tulsa on the city street in front of the old courthouse at the time. And they had weapons. They had guns, both black and white men. And they were fighting like they were back in the trenches of war. And the black men were coming back across the railroad tracks, back into their neighborhood, back into their in their home stomping ground, so to speak. In the meantime, white men were gathering, gathering, and gathering. And so as we get into the middle of the night, early in the morning, just a huge amount of white men come across the railroad tracks. And when they come across the tracks, they come across not only shooting, but they come across and they have airplanes in the sky that begin to drop turpentine balls down on the community, on the tops of buildings. So when you look at the photographs, you see the tops of buildings with smoke billowing out of them. That's because those bombs were dropped down on the building. And then you, all these white men come across with guns because the police had lost control and had given weapons to the white men. So this mob then gets control of things and starts to take over. And as they shoot and kill people on the street, they go into the homes and they loot the homes and the churches, and then they set them on fire. So that's basically what happened in 1921 here.
Thank you so much for sharing that story, a part of for starting us out there. We are going to take a station break, and we will be back. We, if you're just tuned in, this is Ebony's Bones. I'm your host, Ebony Johnson, alongside our co-host, A.J. Lowe, Professor A.J. Lowe. And we're talking with Ms. Vanessa Adams-Harris, who works in the outreach, works with Outreach and Alliance with the John Hope Franklin Center for Reconciliation. And today's show topic is Black Wall Street. And Ms. Adams-Harris just set us up and shared the story of what that was, how it came about, and the undoing of it. After this break, we will get into more of the discussion and allow you to call in. Rakia Bates is on the other side of the glass to take your call at 816-931-5534. Again, that's 816-931-5534. Feel free to call in with questions and or comments. All right, and we're back here on Ebony's Bones. Professor Lowe, you had a statement you wanted to make before the break?
Yeah, one of the things that I find very interesting as far as the Tulsa situation is the fact that the local police department was deputizing white citizens. And with those deputized citizens, they had a complete assault in league, in concert with the National Guard, where they went home to home, took these people out of their homes, looted the, then the deputized citizens went in there, looted the homes, and then burned them to the ground, primarily because of the wealth that these people were had created. That's what upsets me now, and especially right now as far as relation to what's going on in contemporary America, as far as our relations in regards to like race, what people have tried to coin as social injustice. But when it comes to systemic racism and the ability for these people to maneuver out of the most oppressive system, which was Jim Crow, the most oppressive system that the United States has actually created other than slavery, which was Jim Crow, to see these people maneuver out of that and then create not just, you know, make money, but the reports of these people that lost homes, they lost 10-bedroom homes. That's a mansion, right? And the fact that we can't, all the items that were looted have, like Ms. Adams Harris said, she told us that the only item that they got out of the riot was a chair that's actually in the museum, the African American Museum of History in Washington, D.C. It's just one chair, which says that the people who looted those homes kept all those people's items. And some of those items are heirlooms to people that live in Tulsa, Oklahoma, to white Americans that live in Tulsa, Oklahoma, or have descendants that they have passed these items down to in Tulsa, Oklahoma, from Tulsa, Oklahoma. And these items are items that have been looted from black people that they'll never get back, right? And then are now heirlooms as representations for other people as far as pulling themselves up by their bootstraps.
Right, and so some families were able to salvage some of their things and hold on to them, because there's also a desk in the museum that belonged to the Williams family, who owned the Dreamland Theater. And I think that desk was, they were able to salvage that desk out of the ruins. If not, we have to remember too that the community rebuilt.
Right. Yeah, they definitely rebuilt. And I think that is definitely commendable. But I mean, the atrocity itself, that's what keeps getting me, and like how all these people wanted to do was just defend this dude. Like, we just want to make sure he's not going to get lynched. And for the fact that the black people showed up, these gun owners that had purchased their weapons legally showed up to say, we will defend these men with our lives. And that the white mob saw that. And since most of them didn't have guns, they started looting stores, pawn shops.
They looted stores. They broke into the armory.
Yeah.
But we should be able to understand the behavior of white violence and how that violence is then described as a race riot. And so if we get into the psychology of whites and their violence against people of African descent and then just people of color in general, we can understand how they have to kind of hide the violence of whites under the description of race riot, because we only hear riot when we are talking about things pertaining to people of African descent and whites being violent. It looks like there's a relationship between whites and black people when there's violence against black people by whites.
Yeah.
It's always described as race riot. When we're talking about, when we look at our Native history, then we know all those occurrences are called massacres. Right? It's the same kind of thing. We have the white army of the United States government attacking Native villages, and there's a massacre that happens with that attack. But when we go to people of African descent, all of a sudden we have to use the language of riot.
Yeah.
And that, so, yeah, go ahead.
Ms. Adams-Harris, we do have a caller on the line. Ron McMillan with Kansas City. Thanks for calling, Ron. You're on the air. Go ahead with your question or comment.
Good afternoon. My comment is that's the most brilliant and beautiful presentation I've ever heard of the Black Wall Street. And I've done a few programs on it myself and read extensively. Thank you. I didn't get your name, the lady who made that presentation.
Her name is Miss Vanessa Adams Harris. She works with Outreach and Alliances with the John Hope Franklin Center for Reconciliation.
And secondly, John Hope Franklin is black. I love him.
Absolutely.
From the moment I first read his book, he is the father of black history, and he wrote the Bible of black history. And I appreciate you mentioning him. And lastly, the Pullman Porters. Mm-hmm. And the role that they played in taking information out to the world. Remember, we were slaves on plantations. And when we first got off of those plantations and traveled, the Pullman porters picked up magazines and stuff and spread it around. So we began to know beyond the plantation. So I thank you for mentioning the Pullman Porter and how important their role was. And lastly, I want to ask you, in Tulsa today, in that same street, in that same place that's burned, I can pull up on the internet, Tulsa, mm-hmm. Oklahoma, but the street where this happened at, what's there now today? Do we own it? Do they own it? What is it like today?
The street that it happened to was several streets. The street that's known is Greenwood. Mm-hmm. The business district is where it started, which was mm-hmm. as you come across the railroad track was the business district. Okay. We want to think about the area.
Who owns that today? Who's the ownership of those properties today?
There are only 11 little buildings that survived the rebuilding and that survived urban renewal. There are only 11 little buildings. That's in the ownership of the Greenwood Chamber of Commerce, who is African American.
Okay. Thank you so much.
The actual area, though, is 40 squared blocks. Mm-hmm. 40 squared blocks.
Thank you so much, Brother Ron, for calling in. We appreciate that.
Thank you.
You know, I appreciate you.
Yeah, take care. Bless you, too. Oh,
have you ever been... Did he hang up?
Brother Ron, you still there?
Yeah.
Okay. Have you ever been to Tulsa?
No, I've never had. That's why I was wondering what it was. I've never.
It's only a 4-hour drive south. You should go check it out.
I would suggest
that everybody get a chance and read up on the history and if you're in the area, it's a nice place to see.
Thank
you.
Because we not only have Reconciliation Park to visit, which Reconciliation Park is a contemplative space that allows us to take the depth of this happening, but then come out of it as well. There are 2 water features in the park, and there are 10 bronze panels that speak to the Tower of Reconciliation, which takes us from the continent of Africa to the meeting of the sails from the slave ships to bondage, and we go all the way around this, and so we see the occurrences of what these people face, these people of African descent, what they face here in this land right here that we're on, and how they came out of it. And on top of a ribbon of reconciliation. Now, reconciliation is, I always say that reconciliation is a cuss word for people who, like us, who constantly struggle with this condition that we're under here in the United States of America, and really people of color across the globe. And people, particularly people of African ancestry, are faced with this. But reconciliation, I want people to remember and take in, it's a process. It's not a destination. We actually never are reconciled with the harm and hurt that's been done to us. But it is a process of how we as human beings can continue to be together and try to hold each other accountable and responsible, acknowledgement and forgiveness, and moving on and preparing ourselves for the next harm and hurt. Because we haven't stopped harming and hurting each other as a human society on this earth. So that is our struggle and our challenge. And that is really the work of reconciliation. It is not forgiveness and forgetting and then everything is great. No, it is a process. It's not a destination.
Ms. Adams-Harris, can you share with us maybe some highlights of effective ways to reconcile that came from your recent symposium? You're good. Your 2020 National Symposium discussion on reconciliation and technology, natural resources for societal good. Are there any highlights that you're able to share with us that came about from that conference, that symposium?
Oh, my goodness. If you go to our website, which is www.jhfcenter.org, and on there is one of the buttons is the National Symposium, then our speaker, our national speaker, was a wonderful young man who really opened our eyes about information and data. And one of the things that Samuel Sinyagwe does and studies is data. And so he was able to get the Tulsa Police Department's contract, the policeman's contract, and he opened it up. And he opened it up for us and showed us that their union contract gives them protection. And that was the first time that some people had heard of the protection that policemen have, who are supposed to be working for the people, but really are protected under a contract for the city of Tulsa. So it makes you think, well, who are you working for? Are you working for the people? Are you working for a corporation, like, or a government entity? You're not really working for the people because there's no way to hold you accountable to anything. So we had several good presenters. John Franklin, Dr. Franklin's son, was with us. He went over mapping and maps and showed how the maps can give us information about who was where and how the slave trade, really the traveling roads from Africa into South America, Portugal, to the islands, to the United States, how many people were on those journeys. And then we had another presenter that went over Indian Territory with maps to show you where black people were, how they were ingested into the tribes. We had some really good, in each symposium each year, we have some really good eye-opening experiences.
Thank you. Thank you so much for sharing that. I want to circle back to, you talked about that even with the massacre that occurred with Black Wall Street, we still rebuilt as a people. Can you share with us a part of the story of the rebuilding? And as you're talking, I want to let people know you still can call in with questions or comments. We're talking with Ms. Vanessa Adams-Harris, who works with the Outreach and Alliances with the John Hope Franklin Center for Reconciliation. And then, sorry, I should give the number. And the number is 816-931-5534. Again, 816-931-5534.
So one of the tenets of Dr. Franklin's hope in our having knowledge is that that will lead us to a better discourse, and that discourse will create social harmony, and we can be transformed with that discourse. Knowing that the community rebuilt really should get us out of feeling, yes, we should feel horrific that this happened and so many people were displaced. But then we can't stay there because they didn't stay there. They rebuilt, and they rebuilt on their own or with assistance from other people from across the United States. The city of Tulsa did not help them. Some white citizens probably helped some families, as we see things happening today. But for the most part, they rebuilt on their own, and they were able to come right back up to the standard that they were before the attack happened to them.
Wow. I don't hear as much about that, that they actually came back to the same standard.
Yeah.
They did. Almost triple the standard they came back to, because if we look at who these people were, they were workers, for one thing. Right? They knew how to farm. They knew how to clean houses. They knew how to do their business, whatever there was, whatever that was. And then there were some whites in the community, I'm sure, who felt the onus of what happened and tried to make amends in some way. So people had work. And so by the time you get to, if you think about it, that happened in 1921. And then by the time we get to the late 20s, we have a depression. Well, guess what? Greenwood was still rebuilding during the depression. Mm. Right. Black people don't stop. And the idea of the whole thing was one of the photos says, running the Negroes out of Tulsa. Well, guess what? These Negroes didn't run anywhere. These Negroes stayed. And some of them came back to claim their property, to claim what they could, and they rebuilt their home in the exact same spot. So when we look at the design of these attacks on black people was generally to get the land, to get them out of the way.
Mm-hmm.
These black people stayed.
We do have another caller, Abdullah from Kansas City. You're on the air. Please go. Thanks for calling. Go ahead with your question or comment.
Thank you so much. I give honor and respect to all the women on this talk. And the lady who is presenting it is so clear of what has happened. But I think that people need education because people don't know that this happened in Tulsa, Oklahoma, 99 years ago, and the amount of properties, you know, you said 40 blocks, you know, they're strong. You know, so it's like, we like ask people who don't care about us for permission to do what? You know, and everything she's saying is just knowledge. Children need to hear this. You know, corporate America needs to hear it so they can understand where we are economically and where we play a part in the economic engine of the United States. And we don't have to prove it through Tulsa. Right. We are. You know, but to, like, now the messages that are being sent, you know, going on there for, don't do that. That ain't cool. Stop. You know, just keep slapping us. We have to get organized some way, and our own family is where, you know, my own self. You know, if I'm going to love striving to figure this out, where we can, in each other's soul, and pray to the Creator and let it rise. This is ridiculous.
Thank you so much. We have another caller calling through, and I have to clear one line in order to get them through. But we appreciate you for calling, for listening. People can hear this podcast and share it. It's on kkfi.org. We also have a Facebook page at Ebony's Bones on Facebook. Okay. We have another caller. Ron Key is going to patch them through, but I want to let everybody know that we are talking to Miss Vanessa Adams Harris with Outreach and Alliances with the John Hope Franklin Center for Reconciliation, and she's given us some history on the historic Black Wall Street in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Go ahead, Professor Lowe, while Ron Key puts this call through.
Okay. No, because we spoke about this when I visited Tulsa, and I thought about it because you were telling me that, you know, I can't be mad or more upset than the situation that it happened to, than the people that the situation happened to. And I get that. But in this climate, I am one of those African-American young people that is tired of taking the high road. We've been taking the high road and trying to look at the bright side of this whole situation, and nothing has gotten better. So there's a book that I read based off of this that was on this story called Remembering the Dreamland. And that was a very interesting book because it was about a lawyer who was talking about, at first he said that he was arguing against the case of these people getting reparations. But when he started digging through the documents, the legal documents, he realized not just is there a case for reparations, there is a rock solid case for reparations because of the involvement of the state and local governments, how they were involved and how they actually tried to stop these black people from building by putting in fire ordinances, which means that they had to make brick buildings that were used to be wood. They had to make brick buildings and they had to make them X amount of stories high. So they were able to fight. The black people were able to fight that. But even then, the obstacles that they had set up in order to make sure that these black people were failed, those are the same obstacles by the descendants of the people who were trying to stop them then. And now we are having to deal with that now. People telling us or trying to convince us that shooting a black person in the back is okay on some level because they decided that they didn't want to go to jail. So I'm sorry, and I apologize because I get a little frustrated and razzle-dazzle, but when I hear about it and I think about this story, I just get more and more upset because I think about the wealth that was destroyed, that was recreated, and how other people were able to gain wealth through a massacre.
Right, I totally understand.
I do. Ms. Adams says, I want us, for the listener who had called in, I heard a disconnect, so feel free to give us a call back at 816-931-5534, 816-931-5534, and just hold on the line with us because I'll get you through. I'm just trying to bridge everybody's comments, so stay on hold. We'll definitely get your call through, 816-931-5534.
No, okay, so what you just said and what the sister was saying, that's we are right in feeling exactly like we're supposed to. And the thing is that we can't stay still with it. So, and that's what they showed us. And so that's what Dr. Franklin tells us, and that's what the other Carter G. Woodson, that's what they tell us, is to you don't have to hold on to this. We should be telling it. We should be teaching it and telling it in our churches. We can take 15 minutes in Sunday school class and teach about our local history. Wherever you are standing as an African-American parent, a person, where do the African-American community live in your area? Whose house is so-and-so? Who built the school? Who was the principal? What were those teachers doing? Where did they come from? We never should have dropped that ball. That's one of the faults. We dropped the ball.
I agree.
We can pick it back up. But in understanding that, not by no means am I saying that, we can't feel bad about it because they rebuilt. They rebuilt, and they continued on. And as Dr. Franklin said, because they did that, we're here. And so our obligation is to not only endure, because we're in a system that was never created for us. And we really need to get that as a people and understand this system that was created was not ever supposed to, you were never supposed to be doing what you're doing. And so it's still like lava flowing underneath the surface. Racism and racists were built into this system, and that's that lava that flows underneath all of the good things, the Civil Rights Movement, the Civil Rights Act, all that stuff that we can do together. We have to remember that our roots stem out of a thing called racism, right. And it's not going away.
I understand it. I'm just, before we got to go to break, but before we go to the break, I just want to say that when I think about Trump coming to Tulsa in order to have a rally, right? To rally rally a support group behind him that are the descendants of the people who massacred and robbed the people that we are talking about. That he's about to have a rally. And then some of these people actually have, when I think about that, that just infuriates me to no end. That some of these people, when I think about this, people that are going to this rally, some of these people actually might have heirlooms from people that actually got killed or their houses got looted.
That's right. That tells us where we are.
Ms. Adams Harris, we're going to, the conversation gets so rich, we do have to take our last station break, and we'll be right back after our last break. One more. Okay. Stay with us. All right. Thanks so much for staying with us. This is Ebony's Bones. I'm your host, Ebony Johnson, alongside our co-host, Professor A.J. Lowe. We're on the phone with Ms. Vanessa Adams-Harris, who works with Outreach and Alliances with the John Hope Franklin Center for Reconciliation. And we are talking about Black Wall Street. We have about 5 minutes left in the show. So if you have a question or comment, please call in. Ronkia Bates will take your call at 816-931-5534. Again, that's 816-931-5534.
I know that we've talked about that, and like I said, I try not to get too upset, but it just burns me up when I think about it. So
Oklahoma is a red state.
Yes.
No county, we have 77 counties. No county in this state, when Barack Obama was running for office twice, voted, carried Barack Obama. No county in this state.
Not even Tulsa?
No county in this state of 77. So when you understand where you are, it's very easy to see why a president of the United States, who we can say without a doubt is what we know to be a racist. We can say that without a doubt.
100%.
When he chooses to come to a place like Oklahoma, of course.
On Juneteenth?
Of course.
And say, well, I didn't really know. Come on.
And when he has someone like Stephen Miller working with him, who knows darn well.
Or Steve Bannon.
All of them who know darn well what happened here and what that looks like. And so how much attention does that get him? That gets him a whole lot of attention when he wasn't getting any attention before. And now he gets all this attention. And besides that, our COVID numbers have gone up.
And you know what? You know what frustrates me the most is when you say that and you say that he, like I said, he's trying to get attention. And it's just that, like I said, he's getting the attention from the descendants of the people that we're talking about. The people who accosted this black community that burnt 40 blocks down. I mean, we had hotels and grocery stores. Like
40 squared. So be sure and say 40 squared. Blocks.
Yeah, no, you're right. 40 squared.
It wasn't just 40 blocks, it was squared.
Right. Right. I'm saying to think that I don't know any black people that own like hotels. Then you had black people that owned several hotels, several grocery stores.
Well, I mean, when we look at different cities across the United States, especially during the 40s and 50s and 60s, there were black people that had hotels in Chicago, in California, in different places. We have not done the work that we're supposed to do in uncovering our history in our local history, in our local neighborhoods, because they are there and they were there. It's just that we have been under a system that has systemically been denying infrastructure to our various communities and then creating programs like urban renewal that puts a highway right through our communities, and that decimates the community forever.
The question I have is, you're absolutely right. We did own motels and hotels in the 60s and 70s, like the Lorraine Motel where Martin Luther King went, right? But the question is, where are they at now? What happened to
them? That's what I mean, right. What happened to them was the program designed under model cities and other programs, and it was about urban renewal and the redlining. So if you're in a system that's never going to see you as equal and whole and deserving of, and it creates programming that makes sure and ensures that that will be upheld, that you won't ever be given a fair, quote-unquote, shot at things, then, you know, what are we talking about? We're expecting a system to all of a sudden turn around after 500 years, turn around and all of a sudden be for us? No.
I believe in accountability. And one of the things that E. Franklin Frazier said is that we got so caught up in trying to keep up with the Joneses that we end up sacrificing a lot of our businesses. Like, when we talk about black entrepreneurship right now, most of the black entrepreneurs, very few of them actually live in the black community.
Well, I mean, but that's been the design of the system to split you up. That's the design of the system. So if we can remember that we're in a foreign land, we're a foreign people in a foreign land, and we've been in this land for a long time, and this is what is part of the cover-up of its existence, is to keep you shrouded from its truth, that you have to survive. If you survive, we can tell all these stories because Dr. Franklin survived. Dr. Franklin's father, B.C. Franklin, was the probate attorney who sued the city of Tulsa that went all the way to the Oklahoma Supreme Court, and he won that case in 1922 or so to be able to rebuild. That's what they did. That was education. That's how they worked. They worked within a system that was designed against them, and they were able to have some sort of success. That didn't mean that you could rest. This is the process of this system for us, that we think it's about a rest. Entrepreneurship, really? Then we have to talk about who owns the bank. How do you get a loan? If you do happen to be able to get a loan, do you own the land that place is going to sit on? Who's going to get the rent if you don't own the land? If you got to build the building, who's going to build the building? I mean, it's an infrastructure that we don't have in our various communities because we are infiltrated by the system now, and it's designed for you not to have that. It's designed for you not to have that, because that's what has come about.
Ms. Adams-Harris, in our last minute here, what would you like to share with our listeners about Black Wall Street, about just your knowledge, about the experience and the work that you all do at the John Hope Franklin Center for Reconciliation?
I want to thank you, first of all, for having me and for sharing this with your audience. And thank you, Professor Lowe, for coming to visit us and for us having such an engaging conversation even on your visit. I want to also drop something down on your audience and you all to go to the Association for the Study of African American Life and History, ASALA. And if you have not heard of that association, you need to be with it. ASALA was created by Carter G. Woodson. It's in its 104th year, I believe. That is something that we can use and get this information out. Black Wall Street, I want you to think about what we're saying when we say that name, Black and Wall Street. We have called ourselves after our parallel always is that to white people when the bodies of black people actually built a Wall Street and the economy of this nation. And we have said that's who's going to be our marker for our greatness. So we'll just put black on it. So then it'll be like, oh, we're just like Wall Street. No, we are Wall Street. Your body is Wall Street.
All right.
No black on it. It's your body.
Thank you so much. That's a beautiful way to end it. We appreciate you for calling in. And folks, you can look at this. You can listen to this podcast on kkfi.org or on our Facebook page at Ebony's Bones. Please stay tuned for American Roots with Nick Spencer. And then later we'll have the Classical Challenge. I believe tonight it'll be Dr. Mike. Everyone have a beautiful evening and take care and know that you can rebuild.